This is a really good time. This is to be meeting on this. This is a big, important, and maybe even a little hopeful moment in American education, which may sound counterintuitive since we've all been drenched for years in all these statements about how American students perform miserably on international comparisons in math against kids in other countries, about how as we get a better grip on the statistics, we're finding that in many urban districts, only half the kids who start ninth grade ever graduate, how we're finding that the ones that do make it to college often need remedial work, and maybe most distressingly, that we've done very little in closing the achievement gap, the difference between black kids and white kids' performance levels, such that the average African-American high school student is doing work at about the same level as the average white junior high school student. How many of you went to the plenary yesterday in education? Yeah, so you heard Roy Romer, the former head of the LA schools, and Michael Bennett, the head of the current head of the Denver schools, just delivering this sort of dismal assessment of how the schools were doing. And one guy who walked out said, "Boy, that was the most depressing thing I've ever heard." But what was interesting to me was how often they kept turning to this guy, the third guy on the panel, and saying, "Well, you know, he's on the right track," or, "You know, he has the right ideas." And when they were asked sort of what could you do, they'd say, "Well, we'd love to do what he's doing, but of course we can't because we have the teachers' unions and stuff." But so the sense was there that this is the guy and the Knowledge is Power program the place, or one of the places that has the goods. And we're kind of, this is the hopeful part now.
Some of the goods.
Well, more than they felt they had. It would be too much to say it's been like let a thousand flowers bloom, but there has been a lot of experimentation in the last 10, 15 years. There've been, we don't have a monolithic public school, you know, system in the United States anymore. There's charters, and there's vouchers, and there's these networks of little schools, and there's the Teach for America, which has attracted an astonishing number of the best college graduates to come work for 2 years in underserved schools, and there's all kinds of teacher training programs going on, and while all the KIPP people aren't from Teach for America, a lot of them are. And there's enough happening, so you could almost begin to see, and it's been going on long enough, there's kind of an insurgency happening against the power of the K through 12 establishment. And this may sound like an overstatement, but consider that in D.C. they're naming a new superintendent who's come from Teach for America, and Mike Feinberg is on his way to setting himself up sort of as an alternative superintendent in Houston, which is the biggest, seventh biggest district in the country. And they're going to be trying to turn into insiders, even though they probably don't like to think it that way. But they are sort of the generals in the insurgent army. So this is a good moment to find out what are the goods he's got, and are we at a point where it could begin to infiltrate the whole of the K through 12 system? And let's just go for very briefly back to 1994. He's graduated from Penn. He's done some internship. He's gone to work for Teach for America. He's finished, and he's really frustrated. What was the frustration, and what'd you do?
The frustration was that near the end of our first year teaching, you know, we certainly weren't great teachers yet. We were good teachers. We latched on. We found the master teachers in our building in year one, and begged, borrowed, and stole all the great ideas from them. And we thought we were doing a pretty good job with our kids. You know, they love learning. They love coming to our classroom. They love talking about what career they want to have, what college they want to go to. This was fifth grade bilingual class for me. By the way, I was a bilingual teacher because I had a pulse. But the closest I can tell. Figure out why they made
and
me a
what'd you have
teacher.
In the way of language skills?
Now I know Spanish. I had to learn it quickly. So we kind of thought we had a great first year with the kids on the K-12 assembly line. They had a great fifth grade year. Off they go on to bigger and better in middle school. And that naive bubble burst about the second week into our second year in the fall of 93 when our former kids would call us up and those conversations would go like this. You know, "Mr. Feinberg, can I get some homework?" "Well, why didn't we give you homework?" "We're not getting any homework." "Well, how come we don't get any homework?" "Well, then let's take the books home." "How come we don't take the books home?" They said, "We'll ruin the books." And so about by Christmas time, my well-behaved, intelligent, enthusiastic former students We're now skipping just as many classes, smoking just as much dope, joining just as many gangs, becoming just as many parents as a lot of the other kids in that middle school and high school feeder pattern, which was nothing new in those feeder patterns. And it was the same for Dave Levin, who was teaching in another feeder pattern in Houston. And at first, it was frustrating. It was very easy just to go in the teacher's lounge and point the finger at the middle school and high school and just say, why are they screwing up our kids? Little did we know that in the teacher's lounge in the middle schools and high schools, they're pointing the finger back at us, saying, how come they don't send us kids set up for success? We heard one of our mentor teachers speak, Ray Fesquith, who's a great teacher from Los Angeles. And he woke up something inside of us and realized we had to do one last important finger point. We had to look in the mirror, we had to point the finger at ourselves and say, it's within our sphere of influence to do something more than we've been doing.
So you started something very tiny.
That's where the second P comes from, the Knowledge is Power program. We weren't envisioning a school. It was going to be a fifth grade program to try to have a bang up year to set the kids up for more success when they went to middle school. That was our original goal.
Because you thought, oh, middle school will be fine. Middle school is so notoriously easy.
No, we knew middle school was a mess, but we figured we were still very naive in thinking one bang up year at this would fix it. So we, you know, the core of KIPP is there are no shortcuts. So we were going to motivate fifth graders to come to our classroom from 7:30 in the morning until 5 o'clock in the afternoon for 4 hours on Saturdays for an extra month in the summer, give them 2 or 3 hours of homework a night, and just get them on fire, ready to go, just plow through all the mess of middle school. And the 1 year worked really well. Their test scores flew up. You know, they went from 48% passing to 98% passing. Two-thirds had a bilingual label when they came to us. At the end of the year, they now had a gifted and talented label, so they could go to the magnet middle schools. But we quickly realized, to your point, even in the better magnet middle schools, no one's going to push them as hard as we pushed. And so if we really were going to be true to our mission, which is simply not just to have smart fifth graders or smart middle school kids, but our mission is to provide kids with all the academic, intellectual, and character skills they're going to need to succeed at all levels of K-12, college, and the competitive world beyond, we realized we had to turn this into a school, keep our babies, and at least go through middle school with them.
And who were your first teachers that you got besides you guys? Were they all TFAs?
That first year in Houston, it was myself and three other teachers. We were in two modular buildings behind an elementary school in Houston. It was two Teach America Corps members I knew, who now were alumni, and the twin sister of my college girlfriend.
And when you would say to people, and here's the deal, you're going to work 7:30 to 5, you're also going to be available for homework night, you're going to work Saturdays and you're going to work summers, uh-huh. They say...
We're doing it already. You know, this is...
And you don't want them if they weren't doing that already?
Right. We're doing it already, and we're sick and tired of doing this in our one classroom. We have to shut the door to the chaos and the rest of the school, and we're the only car in the parking lot at 7, and our car is the only car in the parking lot at 5. We want to be surrounded by other people who are going to be just as invested and passionate about this as us.
And at that point, you still thought, well, if we do this in a middle school, that'll be really good. It'll be done.
The strategy was we thought if we could keep the kids for 4 years and get them at or above grade level, mm-hmm. given the fact that you know a vast majority of our children were free and reduced breakfast and lunch, they were kids of color, that between the handful of public magnet middle schools in Houston that didn't give me nightmares sending the kids to, and the same with the public high schools in New York, plus the private schools who wanted to diversify but didn't want to lower their standards, and the boarding schools around the country the same, that there would be a huge fight with each other. There would be a bidding war trying to get our kids. And that's what happened. So just in Houston alone in the past decade, my kids have earned over $20 million in scholarships just for high school, not including college.
Okay, so then you thought, well, let's be a little bigger. We have to be a little bigger.
You mean starting more schools?
Yeah.
We didn't really think about that. Again, I wish I could say there was a great strategic plan from the mm-hmm. beginning to do this, but I was doing the school in Houston, Dave was doing school in the Bronx, and we, by the, you know, the 98-99 school year, we got to full size. We had the highest performing middle school in terms of math in the entire state of Texas. In reading and math in the city of Houston, Dave in New York, you know, that school was the highest in the Bronx, the fifth highest all of New York City. And that's when kind of, because of the success of the kids, people started coming and visit a lot and wanted to know what they could learn from this. And unfortunately, a lot of people, at first they became very cynical. They would come and think, this works because we must go out there and recruit really smart poor kids. And they realized that's not what's happening. Or they just thought we were a Thursday school. Those are schools that say, please come and visit, but you have to come on Thursdays. Mm-hmm. You know, and they realized we were not a Thursday school. But they'd get all excited, and I'd be walking. At the end of their visit, they'd be saying, Mike, it's one of the best schools I've seen. And I get to the door, and I'm thinking, just like we were inspired by Ray Fasquith and Harriet Ball, they're going to be inspired to go out there and do great things. And all the inspiration would die. And at the door, we'd start to hear all the yes buts, I called them.
These were people from public school systems, though.
Oh, yeah. Teachers, principals, superintendents, mayors, other state officials. And, you know, we'd get to the door, and I'd hear, this is great, but it can't work where I'm from. It can't work in Dallas, in Chicago, Mississippi Delta, the north side of Houston.
We can hit this later, or we can hit this now, but some of these are very structural yes buts, as in the teachers' union, or as in the school day, or as in the school year.
Legal yes buts, political yes buts, financial yes buts, socioeconomic yes buts, and they all thought that their community was the most screwed up place on the planet. And there's now, I've learned after all these visits, there's about 500 communities in this country all think that they're going to win the title, most screwed up place on the planet. And there's nothing I could do to win that debate at the door. So when people would say, this is great, but it can't work in Dallas and Chicago, Mississippi Delta, I get out my notes and I write down, all right, we have to start schools in Dallas, Chicago, and the Mississippi Delta.
But, my yes, but, before we leave here, you need to try to tell us what actually are the constraints if you're in a regular public school system that isn't going to cut you a lot of slack, how you can go about this. But now go on with your narrative story.
All right. Well, we'll definitely have to get to that. That probably ties into the power to lead from a superintendent perspective and the principal perspective on what they can do. And certainly, depending on labor laws and state laws, some districts and states have an easier time than others. But that's something that hopefully, and we get to the theory of change later on, but that's what we want to show, what can and should be happening at a large enough scale that's going to make people start to think about some of those district and state laws
and
policies.
It sounds like you were already at the point of thinking, wait, we've got something here, and if we just spread it wide enough, the public schools will be great.
Well, I mean, certainly
this is the power part of KIPP.
Yeah, we're Teach America core members, and the mission of Teach America, you know, lives and breathes inside of us, which is one day all children in this nation will attain, you know, will have the opportunity to attain an excellent education, and that was our end goal. We weren't, from when we started KIPP until 2000, we weren't focused on the greater Teach America mission as much as let's focus on our babies and get them on the path to climb the mountain to and through college. But then when we got to a successful point, we realized. And when we grew our schools to the full size, we thought maybe now is when we start to figure out how to leverage the success to be able to help us to make this happen more and get rid of some of those yes buts.
Okay, and now in Houston, Houston being the place of the grand expansion, tell about how that came to be and what you think ought to happen with it. And it's a very slow expansion. It sounds grand. It is grand. Yeah. But it's also over a decade. And
It's a little nuts. KIPP, I guess, is a little nuts. There's really two reasons why we're doing this major expansion right now. One is, the first pragmatic reason is, we've grown up to have, in Houston, a 2,500-child wait list. And that's without, I haven't marketed KIPP since 1997. So it's just word of mouth has spread. And we're only able to serve 1 out of 5 children and families who sign up to want to come to KIPP, because when we just pick the names out of the lottery. So we're saying no to, you know, vast majority of all the kids who want to come. And I hate saying no. I like turning no's into not yets. And so in the not yet mode, we have to think about, well, if we're going to serve more of these kids, we have to start more schools to do that. The other motivating factor was, about a year and a half ago, we looked at the KIPP network of schools around the country. We were up to about 42 schools at the time. Most of them just doing fantastic work, knocking out of the park. Not all. I mean, we stubbed our toe in about 4 or 5 cities where we started schools that were marginally better, if that, than the school down the block, which is not good enough for us.
This is, of course, a luxury that you have. A public school can't say, well, we're taking away your name, you're no longer a Houston public school, whereas you can say you're no longer a KIPP.
Yes, they can. It's called reconstitution.
Yeah.
You can make sure, you can get rid of all the people in the building except the children and start from scratch.
Doesn't happen so much or so smoothly. But anyway,
right.
Go on.
Right. So we realized that, you know, despite the fact that the vast majority of our schools were doing great, and again, about 90% of our schools were doing great, that's certainly a great batting average. That's a Hall of Fame batting average. It's not, personally, we'll never be perfect, but I at least want body temperature. I want 98.6. But while a vast majority were doing really well, we realized it wasn't having any effect on the Uber flywheel of public education. You know, I mean, it was helping the debate in different cities when some people would say kids from certain zip codes and from underserved communities cannot perform as well as other kids. Then we fueled the debate. Then the rebuttal was, well, look at that KIPP school; they're doing it. I mean, so we were helping the debate along, but you know, we weren't doing anything to really help the Michael Bennetts of the world and the reform-minded district leaders who really wanted to see major change in their districts. And we, you know, there was incremental change going on, and incremental change is not enough for what we need, given what you said. So we went back and really thought about what is our theory of change, because we don't simply want to have pockets of and islands of excellence out there. And that's where we decided we want to, instead of in the next decade, instead of starting, you know, we're going to start 10 schools a year. So instead of putting another 100 random dots all over the United States map with more KIPP schools, go where there's existing dots, make those dots bigger, and get this up to enough scale where the success can no longer be ignored, and get rid of those yes buts. With our analogy is we want to have the FedEx effect in public education. And that analogy is when FedEx got up to 10% market share, that's when the U.S. Post Office, which is another government monopoly, they learned how to do next day air as well. So FedEx growth didn't hurt the Post Office, it actually helped them.
Do you imagine that this would be enough of a threat to the Houston School District, which has been very welcoming of you, so that they would actually say, uh-oh, we better get our act together?
We think so. I mean, no one's ever tried this, so I mean, someone's got to be foolish enough to step on traffic and see what happens. And, you know, why not us?
And this means expanding K through 12.
We already started in that anyway. Because we started more middle schools, we had to start expanding all the way through 12th grade, because simply there weren't enough spots and scholarship dollars at Deerfield and Exeter for the growing number of Kippsters. You know, when it was just Dave and me in our schools, we were sending 120 kids a year to the high school. This spring, there were over 3,000 Kippsters going to high school. In KIPP style, you don't wait for other people to solve the problem. If we need more high school seats, we have to create ourselves. Growing down below fifth grade was simply just a 10-year obsession I've had with just getting sick and tired of starting day one of fifth grade with short A goes ah, and let's learn our times tables. Just dreaming, what if the kids came in already knowing those things? And so we started in 2004 growing down with we call it baby KIPP, growing down to pre-K, and then we've been slowly growing up from there, building an elementary school. But this turbo model would be growing to 42 total schools, 16 lower schools feeding into 16 middle schools, feeding into 10 high schools, serving 21,000 kids, which would be 10% of the kids in Houston.
How much philanthropic money does it take to do that?
It takes $100 million. That's why it's a $100 million question.
So how much would it take to do nationally?
We can do the math. I mean, you know,
I mean,
Houston's
so
the fourth largest
what
city.
I mean is, how realistic is this as a real model?
Given the billions and billions of dollars we waste in public education at the state levels and federal levels, I think this is probably a drop in the bucket compared to the total size of what we spend in education. And this would be a reallocation of resources. Of course, we just have to first prove it works.
And you've got how much of that $100 million already raised?
We've raised to date $65 million. Yeah.
And that's great, but that also hasn't changed since March, right?
No, we haven't been. I kind of went out of fundraising mode since March. And we've just been we've been very much in school startup mode, as we have some new schools starting, and the kids get more attention than the dollars at KIPP.
Is this the moment to?
Well, if you want, I mean,
things,
I think we actually covered most of it. Maybe we'll flip through it and see if there's anything on here we haven't covered. And then any more questions from you, and certainly want to hear what everyone else wants to ask too. So I think we covered most of it. We talked about the history of KIPP starting in 95 as the school. We started, by the way, we were a district school for the first 3 years until there was absolutely no more room to house us. So with Rod Page, who was superintendent at the time, we got his blessing to become a state charter. I tried to get a meeting with him to say, you know, we need help finding more space. And I went to his office to try to get a meeting with him, and they basically said, go away, little boy, you're bugging us. So I found his car in the parking lot, and I sat on it for 5 hours. Figured he had to come out of work sometime. So we got his support to start it as a charter school. And then in 2000, when we started replicating KIPP, that's with a large grant from Don Doris Fisher, who were the founders of the Gap, an Old Navy. And they gave us a large grant to start replicating KIPP. And our replication model is to find other great teachers and train them for a year on how to plan, open, run their own KIPP-like school, help them actually get a charter or get a contract with the district, start their school, and then that was run by a local 501c3 board, and then we would just license out the KIPP name. And that's how we started. This is the current, if we track our kids, even though up until 2 years ago we let them go after eighth grade, we still track our kids through our KIPP to College program. We remain the uncles and aunts and basically fill in the holes as they were going through high school to college, because that was our mission. Our current graduation rate, actually that was 3 years ago, was 97%. It's now 99%. That's compared to the HISD graduation rate of 49%. Up as of last year, 85% of our kids were going to college, and that is compared to 15% who were going from the neighborhoods we were serving. That's actually going up as well. This last year's class of 2007, 93% of them are going to college. Again, compared to about 20%, 25% from the urban districts for underserved kids. The reason why KIPP works is our five pillars: the more time on task every day, every week, and every year, choice and commitment. I talked a lot about that yesterday. The fact that parents, students, and teachers choose to be at that school and choose to make commitments to each other, which forces the schools to treat the kids and the parents as the customers who they need to serve. Power to lead, and so this is kind of gets to your yes, but we believe that there should be a well-trained, great school leader in place who has the power to overstaff and budget, so they can decide who teaches in the building, who doesn't teach in the building, and they decide how to allocate their budget dollars to best meet the needs of their kids in their school. In exchange for all that freedom, they're held completely accountable for the results. High expectations is our fourth pillar, which is clearly defined and observable. And for us, that's college prep at all levels, pre-K through 12th grade. And then a focus on results, which is our scoreboard. And while the ultimate goal is to get the kids to and through college, what are we doing daily, weekly, and monthly to track the progress and make sure they're climbing the mountain at the right pace to get there? The basic ingredients of KIPP: no shortcuts, no magic, no secrets, and no excuses. At the end of the day, we feel that this can work or can't work depending on the adults. There's an expression, KIPP, that goes, be the constant, not the variable. And we feel the only variable in this should be the kid's heart. And everything else, we the adults, should hold constant. It's grown up. There's now 58 KIPP schools in 17 states across the United States. As I said, just about all of them are doing great. There's five that are struggling. And so this is where we were in 2004 when we started thinking about a theory of change. It was working really well. At the time, we had two middle schools in Houston, 750 kids. We had this long wait list, but we were not having any impact on HISD as a whole. We were only able to accept one out of five of our kids who were trying to get to our school. And so this is the KIPP Turbo Plan, which Professor Leo Lindbeck in Houston helped us put together, growing to 42 schools, which is going to be growing at a clip of 3 to 7 schools a year, which is, so 1,000 teachers is what we'll eventually need. That's one of the things that keeps me up at night, along with where we're going to get 1,000 great teachers, where we're going to get 42 great school leaders, and how we're going to build a central office that basically becomes a district but doesn't turn into the beast. Those are the three things that keep me up at night. There's a $600 million total cost for all this, and that includes all the capital costs for having facilities, as well as all the startup costs, because our schools start very small with one grade, and they take several years to grow to full size. At full size, they're self-sustainable, but there's operating deficits as we're growing to full size. So $600 million total cost of all this. $500 million, our plan is to be able to do tax-exempt revenue bonds, and $100 million of that would come through philanthropy. We're going to start the schools in the communities where the schools are not performing well, where the parents have no other options. And I'm just going to show you one quick thing. This is actually pretty neat to look at. Let me just take this off real fast. Thank you.
not good with all the technology.
Let's see. So this is actually a map of the city of Houston, which actually, and this would probably be pretty similar to any of our large urban areas in the country. What we did, we went to one of the large real estate, commercial real estate companies in Houston, Weingarten Realty, and asked them, where are you not looking to start shopping centers? And we got all their demographic information. And so this is a map where of the greater Houston area, where the shade areas have to do with median household income. And the darker the shade, the darker the shaded zip code, the poorer the community. We then put on transpose and poverty, all those low dots are the schools that are below average. Yellow is a little bit below average, orange is a lot below average, and red is crap.
And was the shopping center correlation pretty nearly perfect?
Yes. They were
great question.
They in a lot of the white areas, figuratively and literally, what's that?
Clip it on, you know, just hold it.
Well, I was going to get up and move in a sec again.
What's that? All right. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So if you notice, it kind of, unfortunately, it shows that in the poor communities, that's where all the bad schools are. We don't see many dots in the non-shaded areas. And so this was kind of our strategic plan for where we're going to start schools. And as you can see, unfortunately, in the Houston area, which would be no different from Chicago, LA, New York, Philadelphia, DC, there are a lot and lot of places where we can be starting schools where there's a need for the schools to improve. So let me step over here again real fast. We're almost done with this stuff, then we'll get to your questions. So the way we also looked at our theory of change is assuming it really is a lottery, it's really winning a lottery coming to KIPP, because the average KIPPster at a 90% chance of going to college compared to the average kid who doesn't go to KIPP is going to earn, on average, $900,000 more in lifetime earnings as a college graduate compared to someone who's just graduated from high school. The $100 million for 21,000 kids shows that basically the philanthropic cost is $4,500 per seat is what we're trying to raise, so that every year there's a new kid that can sit in that seat. So the neat return of investment is that for every dollar that we're trying to raise, the return to the KIPPster is a 200-to-1 return on investment. And then when you factor in having more college graduates as opposed to just high school graduates or high school dropouts, you're increasing the tax base, that there's less social costs, crime decreases, all things like that. It's actually a $1,000 economic impact for every dollar of philanthropic investment, which has really kind of rallied the Houston community to see this as a neat idea. So you know, we've raised $65 million to date from Houston Endowment, Gates, the Hines family, John Laura Arnold, Walton Foundation, Don Doris Fisher were the major contributors. We also already started doing this bond financing. About a year ago, we did our first $36 million tax-exempt revenue bond to start to acquire land and build facilities as well. We were able to squeak in with investment-grade rating and actually shore it up to an A rating. I know more about bonds than I would think I would ever, as a fifth-grade teacher, should know. But that really is neat that we're able to now, in a roundabout way, access the same bond market that traditional school districts have an easier time using to be able to do their facilities. And so just the impact of Turbo, we hope, is for the students, actually give them a real alternative public education that's a great education, long-term earning power, and set them up for success. For families, hopefully this is a good chance to finally break that cycle of failure in the unserved communities. You know, the benefits of the community. I think all the cities and states in this country, there's basically a race. Whichever city and state can figure this out first, I think here comes the real payoff, because Fortune 500 is moving to that city and that state big time, because I've talked to plenty of business roundtables and everyone's looking to have their businesses be located in places where, one, they can take advantage of an educated workforce, and two, in a place where as they're hiring people, the people they're hiring, their kids have great schools to go to as well. And again, and then our goal is simply, we don't want to compete to hurt HISD in the local school districts. Our goal is, if we can get to 10% market share, is that enough to then push them to run with us and really work to make their schools better? So at the end of the day, we have this equilibrium where we don't have a 2,500 kid wait list anymore, because we're doing a good job serving our kids. The vast majority, the 90%, are in schools where they're being served very well too, so those parents don't want to move their kids to another school. And so that's basically where we're trying to go in the next decade.
Is this doable on a large scale in districts where there are powerful teachers unions?
I would say where there's a powerful teacher union without any kind of FedEx effect and any kind of, I would say, increase in the amount of rage, no. I would say, I think the FedEx effect can happen for a few different reasons. And one thing I want to happen is that if we really do have 10% of the kids in Houston, it's no longer going to be a lottery. You know, right now, when we all watch the lottery on TV and we read in the paper who won $150 million, we're not really mad. We're just thinking that guy's really lucky or that woman's really lucky for winning that. But suddenly, if your neighbor won the lottery, and the family in the church pew next to you won the lottery, and your coworker won the lottery, you start thinking, wait a minute, you start to get a little mad. Why is everyone winning this lottery but me? And at 10%, the other underserved families in Houston are going to know different families in KIPP. And they're going to start wondering, how come they're getting this? How come we're not getting this? And hopefully that raises the level of rage. And that rate is something that hopefully will pound on the establishment a bit.
But in D.C., they already have more than a quarter of the kids in the district in charter schools.
This is a good
and
yes, but.
That hasn't
right.
done
well,
it.
Right. But if we go back to the analogy, well, first off, in D.C., while there are 25% of the kids in charter schools, most of those charters are just as poor, if not worse, than the traditional public school. So go back to the analogy. If FedEx early on lost half of the packages, the U.S. Post Office never would have tipped. So in the whole be the constant, not the variable, a variable cannot be quality. It's not simply let's grow to 10% and just count numbers at 10%. This is, again, the very much easier said than done. Can we grow to 10% and keep the quality as a constant where it is today and really have 90% of our kids going off to college, which, by the way, the interesting stat in Houston, given the current rates, if there's no FedEx effect whatsoever, just by us having 10% of the kids, if we're able to have our rates continue, we will increase the total number of kids going to college out of the city of Houston by 50%. So talk about transforming a community.
Before we get to questions, although I see you're already lined up, could you just talk for very briefly about the quality of a day at KIPP, or you have a KIPPster here? Or it doesn't look exactly like other schools, doesn't sound exact. Talk about SLANT, talk about the
sure.
slogans, talk about just the tonal
sure.
differences.
Well, yeah, actually, Sonia Gonzalez is one of the Bezos scholars who we're very proud of, by the way. She can probably do even a better job than I can describing it, but basically, Sonia, when she came in fifth grade, she got kipnotized, is what we call it. Actually, she got kipnotized earlier because she has a younger sister of two older kipsters, so she, I think, came in day one already knowing most of everything we had wanted to teach them. But kipnotizing for us is about creating the culture with the kids and the faculty, and the parents for that matter, where we create those bonds, teach the expectations, and build a culture we want where the kids understand the expectations, and they understand the values of what we're trying to do, which we basically boil it down to two. There's two very simple rules at KIPP. We learn how to keep it very simple. Work hard, be nice. It's basically all we expect from the kids. We say, if you're doing those two things, you're doing everything we're asking you to do.
What about sit up straight,
right.
look at the person who's talking?
Well, that's part of it. And so that's all.
Is that
all
be nice?
Yeah. So we, in the room, we have a lot of, the way we teach focus in the classrooms, we call it SLANT. Which stands for, in the classrooms, we expect the kids to sit up straight, listen, ask questions, nod your head, because when you ask questions, when you're understanding,
could
you nod
your
head.
Could you just see everybody nodding like that? Heads, wasn't it gratifying?
It. Let the teacher know you understand, and then track the teacher, or track whoever's speaking in the room. And so that's just one, we have lots of raps and songs and chants and dances. I mean, we do a lot of things to make this fun. I mean, obviously, fun has to be a value. We're not going to motivate kids to come to school from 7:30 to 5 on Saturdays in the summer if it wasn't fun. And so we build that culture early on. So when the middle school storm hits, which it hits, I don't care what neighborhood you live in, underserved, overserved, it's seventh grade, eighth grade are tough years. But because we've established this relationship with the kids. And because we've built this culture, we can ride through that storm together relatively easily.
Okay, let's take a couple of questions, and then I'll have some more, too.
Hi, I'm Laurie Tisch, and I'm chairman of the Center for Arts Education in New York. I'm also vice chair of Teachers College and an education funder. So I see lots of great programs, yours amongst them.
Thanks, Laurie.
But it's a great program. My question is, because I see a lot of other programs, which I know you know well, Jeffrey Canada, Women's Leadership School, even some of the public schools, Lorraine Monroe, you know, the work George Weiss is doing, I'm wondering, without your naming any, how you think that they're doing, and because they're, you know, they're all claiming 95% going to college, not claiming, I mean, I think it's true. And I'm wondering if they're doing it for less money. When I met with Eva Moskowitz just before she started, what is it, Success for All? She said that her goal is to do it for the same cost of educating of the public schools. So I'm wondering if you think that that's actually an actual claim, and how you think those other programs compare to yours, you know, Lorraine Monroe and all of those.
We're proud of the fact that there's a growing larger team and family that KIPP is a part of that are doing this work as well. Uncommon Schools, Achievement First, Noble Street, Green Dot, Village Academies, New York. It's neat to see that this is growing a lot with Teach America alumni, by the way, not all, but that there's a growing movement to start these types of new schools that more or less have these five pillars, however you want to set them up. And I think basically, you know, Dave and I now host a conference every year where we get all these people together. We actually did it the first time here at Aspen Institute 2 years ago to get in a room without any funders, without the media, and just basically talk about the brutal facts and what we're proud of, what we're not proud of, where we need help from each other. And I think, you know, some of us have certain schools are doing better than others. Some models are slightly different than others, but I think I'm just proud of the overall success of the greater movement.
Could you in not terms imagine of the, that having a much bigger effect if you all were in some formal way coalitioned and putting on pressure?
I like the way we did it with KIPP, which is originally we weren't thinking long-term. We were just keeping our heads down, focused on the here and now and our kids, focused on gaining success, and then let that success build into things, into bigger things. I think what you're talking about is would be neat to see happen in the future, but I think we're all young enough in this movement. I think we all need to keep our heads down. We need to be talking with each other and help each other out as much as possible. You know, again, work hard, be nice. I think we need to establish more results before we really figure out how to leverage that group results. In terms of, that's also a great question, the cost. You know, $600 million certainly is a heck of a lot of money, and even $100 million in philanthropy, but it's not actually any more than the traditional public school spends. You know, to go apples to apples, most of that are capital costs, which the districts have through the bonds. And while some of it's for our startup costs, I said full size, we operate on the same per pupil dollars that the traditional school districts in Texas receive. And we will not do any fundraising at full size except for the kids selling chocolate bars, which I like having them sell lots of chocolate bars. I think it's important though to do it at the same dollars, otherwise that turns into a huge yes but. You know, if we were spending more money than the traditional public school system, then are there really lessons learned for the rest of the public schools? So we need to do this on the same dollars, but we need to raise this money given the deficit we're starting from in the first place. Nationally, we don't. I don't know if KIPP New York does or does not. We go back and forth.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Laura McCluskey. I was a teacher for 7 years, and now I'm a doc student at Stanford. And I really admire the autonomy that you give teachers in the classroom. I've interned at KIPP, so I know a little bit about it. But I'm really curious how you address teacher pay and mm-hmm. teacher burnout.
Yep. Teacher pay, we pay our teachers for all the extra time during the week and the weekends and the summer. So our teachers make about 20 to 25% higher salaries than they would make if they were working at the traditional public school in the community. Now, we afford that on the same nickel because we are very lean on administrative costs. We don't have lots of assistant principals running around our school. And I was joking earlier this morning, we don't have an assistant superintendent of left brain instruction. You know, so all those savings on the mid levels of bureaucracy get pumped into the classroom, mainly to pay the teachers the extra salary. In terms of burnout, no joke, starting a brand new school for the first few years, we have high teacher turnover when we start new schools. And I don't think there's any shortcuts or any ways around that. Starting a brand new school from scratch, like starting any small business, it's just a crazy 24/7 venture. And some people have more stamina for it than others. But the important thing is that that's got to be a means to the end, and there has to be a light at the end of the tunnel. And after startup mode, there should be no more excuse for high turnover. In the original KIPP Academy Middle School in Houston, that's now entering its 13th year, the average KIPP experience of all the teachers is 6 years, and the average total teacher experience is 10 years. So this is not being staffed by just 22-year-olds who are going to sprint for 2 years and that's it. We've taken more of a marathon approach. And we basically, as much as we're student-centric, I think we're very teacher-centric. Beyond the extra pay, we set this up in a very teacher-friendly way. The teachers, and that goes to work environment, which is, the biggest reason why teachers leave education, especially underserved communities, is not the salary as much as it's the work environment. The teachers all have keys to our building. They come and go as they want. No one's guarding the copy machine. Go make as many copies as you want. You can treat like a professional. We expect our teachers to be on cell phone call at night to help kids with homework, but we give them their cell phone. We set up a daycare now in our schools, so teachers that have young children can actually have their kids at school with them in a daycare. And we're always looking, what other perks like that can we be putting in here to make this more sustainable as we grow?
Bravo on everything you're doing. So I'm a passionate arts educator, and I'm wondering how you focus on arts education in your KIPP schools.
Yep. Art is art. The fine arts, athletics are very important to us because, again, we're not simply trying to have smart 8th graders or smart 12th graders and pass the state tests. Our mission is to get the kids to and through college. And they're not going to be competitive applicants to college if all they can talk about as 12th graders is, I know how to compute and I know how to read. Right, they've got to have diverse interests and hobbies and lots of different skills, and so, unfortunately, most schools and districts do what we call the tyranny of or. They see it as an either-or choice. We're either going to have great extracurriculars, or we're going to get the kids to do better in reading and math. And for us, every time we're faced with an either-or situation, we try to turn it into an and. And that's a big reason why we have the more time, because we have the 7:30 to 5 o'clock day. And the extra time in the summer and on Saturdays, we can have more time for reading and math and writing without sacrificing science, history, fine arts, and physical education. Some of our schools, like in Houston, we take a more diverse approach. We have our kids playing sports, and they're in band, and they're painting and a little bit of everything, which means, our basketball team is so-so, and our our band squeaks, but it's good. Or the other approach is you got KIPP Academy New York, which has a rhythm and string orchestra that's quickly being regarded as one of the best middle school orchestras in the country. The last 3 years they've played Carnegie Hall, the Apollo Theater, and the Lincoln Center. And they're the VH1 Save the Music poster children. And they spend 2 hours a day. That's their focus, is all on music. So some of our schools have that kind of focus. Some have more diverse interests. But either way, it's very important to us to prepare our kids for success in college and beyond, not just to pass a test.
I'm Becca Basson. I'm a Bezos scholar, and I'm in high school. And I go to a typical public school, and I can't imagine spending that much time in school. And you already kind of touched on my question by emphasizing the value of community, and I think that that doesn't get enough attention. But how is your day, your school day, structured so that it maintains the attention of your students?
Yep, that's a very good question. Congratulations, by the way, on being a Bezos scholar. First off, again, our teaching, we realize, cannot be dry and boring. Again, what we have a deal with the kids. We expect them to slant and pay attention, but we don't expect them to make huge sacrifices and be martyrs to do that. So if they're going to give us their attention, what are we doing to give them some interesting instruction in return So that's, and we talk about that explicitly with the kids, and that's the deal. They're working hard, but we're a team and family, so are the teachers. The 8 o'clock to 3 o'clock part of the day looks like a traditional day. There's time in the morning for additional before 8 o'clock for additional tutorials, and there's some extra logic games and thinking skills we're doing with the kids, and we're checking homework, and there's some counseling that happens for our Kipsters in crisis. From 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock, there's some study hall time for them to go back and get more one-on-one or small group tutorials or get a jump on their homework. And then we launch into sports and fine arts and lots of extracurriculars as well.
Mm-hmm. Mike, on teachers, you have to hire 1,000 new teachers.
Yes. 1,000 new great teachers.
1,000 new, exactly. And I'm wondering, have you yet had applications from and hired from teachers who went to a regular ed school and have been teaching in a terrible public school, and you have done it?
We liberate them. We free them from the matrix.
Do you imagine that we're moving toward a sort of bifurcated, here's the traditional ed school group that has been in our public schools, and here's the insurgents?
Probably, yes. Unfortunately, our ed school, we all have a responsibility to improve and change and to meet the needs. And I think the ed schools are also need to realize that they need to do things differently. And while I'm not an education major, I certainly had to go take ed courses through my Teach America years to become a certified bilingual teacher. And those courses did not do anything to help me become a better teacher. So the ed schools, like the districts and like every other parts of this establishment, need to also evolve and improve to meet the needs of what the teachers need to be able to do to be set for success today.
Hi, my name is Luke. I taught for Denver in 2 years, and I found the homeschool disconnect to be quite challenging.
Yep.
I'm wondering if you could speak about your relationship and expectations with parents.
Sure. We, that's a buzzword that usually gets defined as parental involvement. We changed that to parental support because we realized that if we expected the parents to be involved, we're not setting them up for success in all cases because a lot of our parents are working two or three jobs just to put food on the table and pay rent. So they cannot necessarily be very involved in the school. But that doesn't mean they can't be supportive of the school. We established that from the very beginning. Despite a 2,500-kid wait list, we will still go into the community and we enroll the kids who get picked in the lottery in their home. We don't wait for them to come to school. We go to them on the night or on the weekend and sit down around the breakfast table and sign the Commitment to Excellence form. Where we start new schools and communities, our new school leaders are literally going through the apartment complexes, knocking on every door, going through the playground going, are you 9 years old? And if so, where's your mother? I need to talk to her. And we're just really much grassroots signing up the kids. Because we do it in the homes, we have completely erased any barrier that potentially exists between school and home. If we can go all the way to the home, then we've established that connection. Now it's actually easier for the parents to want to come to the school as well. We don't expect them to be there every day, but when we do expect them to be there for report card conferences, for open houses, 99% show up. And the 1% who doesn't, there's a 6'4" bald man who's knocking on their door saying, why don't you show up?
First of all, it sounds amazing. And I would love to hear in more detail how your curriculum and what actually happens, your teaching methods are different from what happens in a regular public school. But also, I think I heard you say, and I have to say my speed of listening is not as good as your speed of talking. So I heard you say that your goal is to get kids to and through college.
Yes.
But the statistics you gave were just on how many attend college.
Right.
Do you have statistics on how many graduate?
We're just starting to get college graduates now. Our oldest Kipsters, if they were on the four-year college plan, unlike their former teacher who was on the five-year college plan, they would just start have graduated this past spring. We have to, a lot of them are on the five-year plan, which frankly I'd be very hypocritical to get mad at them about. But they all know that our goal for them is no matter what's going on in their home life, with family, with everything, we're pushing them to all finish in 6 years. And there's very few horror stories we have of kids dropping out of college, which is actually pretty good because we used to say, get the kids to college. And that was another naive bubble that burst for us because we didn't realize, and this is a scary stat, that for underserved kids, the college dropout rate is higher than the high school dropout rate. which is scary.
Can you talk a little about how you stay in touch with them for that
sure.
many years?
We established this Kip to College program where we have counselors that focus just on the alumni. And they travel around and make sure that, you know, we establish good bonds with all these other high schools they go to and now colleges. And that program is expanding. In fact, Vanessa Ramirez, who's one of our original Kipsters, wave, Vanessa, she's now a Kip to College counselor who's actually going to be traveling the country, helping the other Kipsters in college with whatever crisis they're going on, because she got through it. So who better to help the new Kipsters in college than Vanessa?
Is this only if they call, or is this Vanessa's going to drop in?
You'll be
seeing her.
Both. Certainly we want to establish it so that we want them to call us proactively. We've also realized that we have to be like the CIA and have excellent intelligence.
the different methods that you use, how
right.
does it look different in the day?
I don't know. I wouldn't say that there's not a lot of, in terms of curriculum, we haven't reinvented the wheel. And we realize we are standing on the shoulders of giants. I mean, there are amazing teachers and philosophies of education that have come well before us that we've just begged, borrowed, and stole, and we're very appreciative of all that. I think for us it's not the curriculum as much as the instructional delivery, and we really try to master the craft of instruction and how you get a classroom to focus, how you pace the lesson, how you check for understanding, and our end goal of any lesson is not simply to say we've covered it, but we've mastered it, which is, again, so if your end goal is mastery, that then starts to change some things you're going to do in the lesson and how you teach, how you do guided practice, how you do independent practice, how you assess.
Like what? How does that? I'm sort of really trying to get a picture. I think we've all sort of asked similar questions. We've heard, you know, how does the school day, how do you get kids engaged to want to stay there that long? But what is it? How is that different? How do you,
it's nothing different. You can walk into any school in this country and even the worst schools in the country, there's several classrooms that will have excellent examples of great teaching going on. The worst schools in the country, it's just there's only a few examples of it. You know, the best schools, it's classroom to classroom. I can't point to like one type of method. It's just like the overall way the teachers are trained to how to teach a class and check for understanding.
That was Michael Bennett.
No, that was Michael Bennett.
Excuse me, I didn't teach you, but it was a very good example of good teaching.
Michael, you want to share the example?
You want to take it over there?
The example that I used yesterday. So the example was a lesson on the Holocaust where. The teacher showed a German guard talking about his experiences during the Holocaust, and the question for the kids, then it was turned off. And as somebody, by the way, not a K-12 person, 2 years ago I would have said, wow, that's really cool, because they're showing videotape and now they're engaging the kids. But the teacher said, what was the attitude of the guard? Somebody said he hated the Jews. And the next question was, why? And without giving kids enough time to react, what we call wait time, the teacher went on and said Germany was having a depression and they scapegoated the Jews. And you could see in an instant that nobody knew what depression meant in that context or what scapegoating meant in that context. So unpacking these kinds of things is a good example of teaching. I want to take this opportunity, since I was invited up here, to observe to the question that was just asked about the quality of teaching. I think the fundamental issue here is a sense of efficacy of the adults that are in the school. They understand from the outset that they have a responsibility for the learning that takes place in that school, and that if the kids aren't learning, that has something to do with the adults in that school. And we see that in other public schools as well, not just charters, but KIPP happens to do that very well. It's an ethic of what they do, and I think it's a reminder that, to come back where the interview started, that we need to adopt that as our view in terms of reforming these school districts. In other words, we as communities need to understand that there is an efficacy that we have to demand the kinds of results that we need to see. And we need to get past this idea that what we face is an intractable problem, because as long as we think of it as an intractable problem, it will never be solved. But I think that we can solve it a lot faster than we imagine if our belief systems were different than they were about our kids and about ourselves.
Thanks, Michael, for bailing me out. It's better at the parents of my
son. We lost a questioner here. Is Hi. He still around, who was in line
Donovan,
for a long time?
Do you still have a question, Donovan? No?
No. Okay.
Are you sure? What, if any, relationships do you have with teacher training programs? If you want 1,000 new teachers, how are they going to bloom?
Yeah. We certainly have a relationship, as you can imagine, with Teach for America. Probably about half of our teachers in Houston around the country are Teach America alumni. Several of our cities, including in Houston, we're starting to take new Teach America Corps members starting this year. We have a good relationship with the University of St. Thomas in Houston. That's especially at the early childhood level. That we're going to probably work with them. They have a great dual language certification track that for our teacher aides, our teacher fellows in the early childhood classrooms. That's how they're going to get certified and trained, in addition to what they're doing at KIPP. But then the big thing is, and this is the other big idea, my big idea for us here in the festival is KIPP Turbo, what we're doing in Houston, to try to scale this and then have an example for what other cities around the country can emulate to. My partner in crime, Dave Levin, his big idea is actually to create a brand new teacher training university to the question before, the focus is not going to be as much on pedagogy, on how to really become great teachers in the classroom. And the curriculum is going to be, all these teachers are going through the program, they're going to be in the classroom, and their classroom will be the curriculum. So instead of learning about the different learning styles in a lecture hall, which I always found rather ironic, you learn about the learning styles actually in the classroom with the kids. And when you learn about assessment, it's actually you've given a test to the kids and you're great. He's doing that in New York. They're going to grow that to, I think, a couple thousand teachers they want to train annually over the next several years. Robin Hood has been a huge supporter of this effort, and I think they're going to start in a very small way, because KIPP always has big ideas but starts small, this fall with, I think, a 2 or 3 dozen teachers, and they're going to try to grow it from there. Have this brand new. And the neat thing about that teacher training university, the teachers will only get certified and get their master's if they can demonstrate closing the achievement gap in their classroom. Yep.
My name's David Jones. I started 27 years ago as an English teacher in China, and watching that system change in that intervening time period has been very inspiring. I now live in Louisville, Kentucky, where the Supreme Court last week invalidated our student assignment plan. Yeah. And where a new superintendent started day before yesterday. And my question is, do you have any advice for civic activists, business leaders, on what we should be pushing the local school bureaucracy to do to create change? Like everywhere else, we've got 30 or 40% of the kids who are coming out uneducated. Any advice for us?
I think if you boil down our model to the basic ingredients of why it works, it's great teaching and more of it. And great teaching does not come, as much as there are great tools out there and there's computer software programs that are great and certainly in reading text and different training modules that are all great, it's a human capital. It's the human resource, the most important resource of all. And so whatever the district can be doing to partner with, first off, the local ed schools, for them to make sure that the pipeline is quality people. And not just that the training is going on, but what are we doing to attract the best and the brightest into the ed schools as opposed to the business schools and the law schools and the med schools. That's one thing. I think also, what kind of alternative certification program can we put in place so that for mid-career changers, for people who are very smart, very talented, have got a wealth of experience, how can we make it relatively as easy as possible to get them to be able to be teachers and then give them the training they need to be great teachers? More than anything, because we need, the most important thing a district can do is have great teachers. And I think that's the most, I would say that's the most important thing they can do, and then certainly looking to how you allocate resources to lengthen the school day and things like that would be other things to look at. But I think the focus should be on great people. And not just teachers, but I should mention school, and then the critical one is also the school leaders as well, and having great principals.
My name is Phil Rothblum. We've supported a program for giving public school students education on weekends and through the summer.
Yep.
Have you given any thought to expanding the KIPP program into something like that to reach more kids?
Yeah. Well, we actually do already. I mean, we're actually working with our kids on Saturdays and for an extra month in the summer is our standard KIPP year. My favorite speech to the kids every year is it's the last day at the end of May, the traditional school year, where I tell them, boys and girls, it's been an amazing year. We've learned a lot. We've laughed. We've cried. See you in a week. That's a fun speech. But in terms of starting just simply weekend or summer programs to reach more kids, for us, this is kind of like an all or nothing thing. I feel that while, first off, congratulations and thank you for what you're doing. I know one point of frustration I've talked to other people who try to do after school programs and things just on the weekend is there's a feeling sometimes of feeling like Sisyphus, that we're pushing the boulder up only to have it, you know, when the kids then go to their traditional public school during the day, you know, everything gets undone, which gets done in this great program. And so, again, this is one of those things where I think cannot be an either or. You know, how do we get good after school programs or focus on the traditional day? I think that one of the good things that worked about KIPP is it's all encompassing. It's not a disjointed before school, regular day, after school, weekend, summer program. We've put it all in under one roof with one faculty, one culture, one expectation. And I think we have to find a way to kind of connect all those dots out there that all try to do really good things in isolation and try to bring them all together.
Also, I'd like to know, how do you create the roof for your new schools? Do you build buildings or look for existing spaces?
Pragmatically, if we can do existing spaces and, you know, schools that have closed down, church space, things like that, we'll do that. But assuming that at some point, you know, when FedEx got to 10% market share, the post office didn't jump up and down for joy and say, thank God, they're now going to make us better. We love them. At some point, probably the local district is not going to be very happy with us. They're not going to want to share vacant space they have. And so that's why there's that $600 million cost, because we're assuming that at some point we're going to do this all for ourselves, which means acquire our own space and build our own buildings.
Thank you.
Yep.
Hi, Mr. Feinberg. I'm Ben Alterman, a Bezos scholar.
Ben.
How are you? I'm wondering what role the classics, philosophy, and interdisciplinary education play in the KIPP program.
That is a school, because of our power to lead and the fact that the school leaders get to establish, with their staff, establish their own curriculum, that plays out at a school-to-school level where they decide how much time and how much focus that takes in the curriculum. But we don't, because we don't, from all the 58 schools from the central point, we don't give them the curriculum what they're going to use. So they know they have to start with the state standards and from there put them on steroids to make them college prep. And exactly then what they're going to focus on in all that time is up to each individual school.
All right. Thank you.
Yep, good question, Ben.
Can we hear a little bit more about the yes buts? What you say is so persuasive. I want to hear more about why this is not happening universally everywhere.
Yes buts. Again, the power to lead, the fact that unions tend to be very protective of the current collective bargaining agreement and the work rules that 40 years ago certainly served a point to make things better, but I think a lot of us believe now they've gone a little bit too far and are now not helpful to making schools better but hurtful. I think yes buts are simply just looking at this on the scale of, all right, this works for 300 kids in this one school here, but you know how is this going to help me in Chicago for where I have 600,000 kids? There's not a clear connection of how we scale what's going on in one school to make it system-wide. There's different than just about being a charter school and having some, we're having less and less freedom as charter school these days, but still charter school allows for some more freedom in who we're hiring
and free from some of the bureaucracy, and again, how the lessons those apply. My favorite story on that is I had several years ago, I had a state representative from Texas come to a surprise visit to KIPP. She said, I'm here because I've heard a lot about the school and I want to see it. And she was very quiet throughout her visit. At the end of the visit, she said, Mike, that's one of the best schools I've seen, and this is exactly why I'm opposed to charter schools. And I don't understand what you mean. She goes, you're able to make this work because as a charter school, you can do all the things that traditional public schools can't do. I said, well, with all due respect, Representative, why don't you then legislate it, change the laws so that all of the public schools can do what we do too? And she got quiet and said, I never thought of it that way before. So one that demonstrates that we need to improve on critical thinking in Texas. But then two, it demonstrates that just we have to, again, can we scale the success large enough so that people start to realize, you know, instead of saying, hey, you know, it works over there but can't work here, why don't we put, if it's working there, then logically, let's take the same conditions and put it for the rest of the system as well.
But Mike, in the real world, imagine through some weird twist of fate that you found yourself in September the superintendent of schools in Detroit or Topeka or something. What could you do right away? What would you do right away? What would you tell someone else to do right away?
I'd call up Michael and say, "What, you know, what do I do first?"
You could have a job
with Denver. Man, that's a you know.
But that's a fair question.
It's a fair question. It's a tough question. Talking about the pillars I would try to do, I would probably do what I could to, one, lengthen school days, figure out how to just have efficiencies in the system to afford to do that to some extent. I would, again, I would really work on the pipeline, the quality of teachers, and to do that, probably the bigger lever, I'd work on the principals, because if you have great principals, then they, in turn, can help find, recruit, and train great teachers. Even if you start with a mediocre teacher, a great principal can help that mediocre teacher become great. So I'd work a whole heck of a lot on the principals. And I would probably also then, for choice and commitment, I would probably try to open up the school and set boundaries so that families weren't locked in to one school they had to go to, but that there really were options of choice within that public education system. And I would start from there and try to just get that flywheel to turn. Michael, how's that sound?
I wonder if through your experience in Houston you have developed a particular approach to ESL.
Mm-hmm. Our approach to the question of how we approach ESL and bilingual, which is we believe in mainstreaming the kids into English. At the same time, we don't want them to lose their second language. Primarily in Houston, it's Spanish. So fifth and sixth, when we start with the kids in fifth and sixth grade will pretty much be all English, because at that point, while we have a lot more time on the clock, we still feel the pressure, and that after day one, we have less than 8 years to get the kids ready to go to college and be successful there. So it's all English, fifth and sixth grade, and we start putting Spanish back in seventh and eighth grade into the curriculum. With our lower school, because we have so much time on the clock, we actually do dual language. So for our pre-K kids, they're in all English for most of the day, but then for an hour and a half, they go to an all-Spanish classroom, where slowly but surely the amount of Spanish is rising as well. I should mention, as great of our results are with KIPP in the middle schools, there's something revolutionary going on with the lower school we started in Houston called KIPP Shine, our first one. We started with pre-K kids, 4 years old, at the end of first grade, so 3 years later, and this is 98% free breakfast, free lunch. This is 99% minority, and this is three-quarters coming in speaking basically just Spanish when they started with us. On the Iowa Test of Basic Skills, the reading comprehension, the average child was at the 91st percentile, and they were reading at the third grade level. So what achievement gap. That I think, is going to revolutionize even everything within the KIPP world, what we're doing. So all the work hard, be nice, more time on task, as much as we're probably work in middle school, it is just growing by leaps and bounds at the lower school level, which we're really proud about.
Mm-hmm.
Hi. I work with Kip Pride High School in Gaston, North Carolina.
Nice. Out in the peanut field. Good.
Pardon?
Out in the peanut field.
Yeah. I go to Hamline University in St. Paul, but I work with an organization called Students Today Leaders Forever. And we have a core program called the Pay It Forward Spring Break Tour. And we paid Kip Pride High School a stop this spring. And we now work with them, and we're partnering up. And I'm curious what role you'd like philanthropic organizations like Students Today Leaders Forever to take in your school system?
Oh, I think in terms of time or money or both?
All the above.
All the above. First off, time. You know, they've heard the 6'4" bald man say every day, buy La Pena, buy La Pena, buy La Pena. It's worth it, it's worth it, it's worth it. Keep working hard, keep doing it. You know, if you remember the marshmallow experiment from the 1950s, the kids can either have the one marshmallow today or the bag of marshmallows in the future. Tell them, don't eat the marshmallow. You want a bag of marshmallows in the future. Kip Philadelphia has a shirt that says, don't eat the marshmallow. I love it. You know, that's as much as they hear from us, they need to hear from other, as many different faces and voices well, that it's worth it and keep doing this. Because outside of our schools, in the community, they hear every other possible opposite message why they shouldn't be doing
right.
this. So we need volunteers in our schools. We need volunteers to basically take our kids on unique experiences to open up their eyes to all the wonders of the world, that if they do stand, track, and climb the mountain, all the wonderful things they're going to see from the top of that mountain, which they're going on faith from when we recruit them in.
Do you have anything in place right now where any of the schools have an exchange program with universities so that we could, because that's what we're working on right now with
yep.
Kip in Gaston, is we want to, we want to send these kids on a Pay It Forward tour because it's a revolutionary experience. But we'd also like to do an exchange program where we could bring these kids up. There's a million colleges in the Twin Cities, and they could experience the college life with college students.
That would be neat. I'd love to talk to you about that. We do. You know, we take the kids on lots of trips during the year, and we visit. By the time our kids are done with us after 4 years of middle school, they've been to probably at least 24 college campuses.
Great.
Well, again, that's our focus. By the way, I should mention that the school that she's talking about, North Carolina, this is in Northampton County on I-95, just south of the Virginia border. You know, North Carolina, they rank all the schools in the state. The local middle school and now the local high school of 2,600 schools is something like 2,534. Kip Gaston College Prep in the state of Texas, number 2. Pretty cool. What's going on out there?
My name is Carrie Sherman, and I've been a teacher for a long time, both in big cities in the United States, New York and Miami, and in 5 different countries. And one of the things that I've observed is that the teachers everywhere, including the United States, overwhelmingly go into teaching for the right reasons. But something happens along the way. It isn't that they aren't good teachers and they don't care and they didn't really
right.
want to make a difference.
Right.
And one of the things that I think I hear you saying that makes me so happy is that you are giving your teachers some of the same motivation that you want your teachers to give the students.
Oh, yeah.
And you're not overwhelming them with forms to fill out so that they don't even have time to plan their classes. And I wish that there would be a way that some of this could get into the public schools. Just an example, a program that I've developed for the New York City schools was supposed to start in summer camps this week, but the summer camps are starting a week late because the Department of Health decided they had to test some of the health facilities in the buildings.
Right.
And it's always this red tape that goes on, and then teachers get down about it after a while. How long can you fill out these forms? And the principal's the same thing. And
right.
I'm assuming in the KIPP schools you let your teachers really teach. And I wonder if there's a way we can spread this to some of the other programs and schools that also have some great, motivated, caring, wonderful people in the classrooms.
I learned from my former boss, Ann Patterson, who's assistant superintendent in HISD, to let the stallions run. Find great people, give them the tools they need, and let them do their thing. And that's the way that's hopefully, again, that to me, that's going back to the FedEx effect. When we hire great teachers away from the traditional schools, I want that principal in the exit interview asking the teacher, well, why won't you stay here? And I want that teacher saying, well, I'm going to a school where I'm going to be, where again, I'm not going to feel isolated. I'm going to be around other colleagues who also want to work on instruction and work on this craft. I'm not going to have 45 minutes of planning a day. I'm going to have 2 hours of planning a day. You know, I'm going to have a daycare for my kid. I have access to the building 24/7. They're letting me teach. I don't, you know, they're letting me teach in the freedom that I wanted, the style I want to teach in, and use them. And if I want to teach in a certain way and have materials, they're going to get them for me, and they're going to hold me accountable. And then I want the principal to say, well, if I don't start doing these things, I'm going to lose more teachers too, so I might as well start adopting some of these best practices.
Right.
And then pretty soon, it'll get harder for me to recruit teachers out of that school, but that for me, right. that's a step forward.
Right, so you're supporting the teachers, which is not widely done in this country.
People make the difference, and that's why the schools are successful.
Seems like this is probably our last question, yeah?
Or can you do two more real quick? And then okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes, hi. I live in Oakland, California, which is a great city, but it's very diverse. It's got some great elementary schools. It's also probably got some of those worst schools in the country kind of thing. The high schools are not very good.
Right.
I have a one-year-old. I want my kid to go to Oakland Public Schools. How do I involve the leaders of the businesses, like Clorox, which is a big employer in Oakland, as well as get something like KIPP in Oakland, California, so my kid can go to
We actually
Public
are in Oakland. There's a school called KIPP Bridge. That is the middle school. I think eventually we'll probably grow down into a lower school as well. But there is a KIPP school there, and there's certainly through the new school initiative, there's been a lot of work to start other alternative new public schools in the District of Oakland, which hopefully, again, collectively start to have that effect on the rest of the system, would be our hope. Thanks.
We're a small part of the funding of your new school that you're opening in Kansas City this fall.
Okay.
Now, when you expand to a new community, are you part of the expansion team? Are you the expansion team? And how closely do you monitor that? And then the balance between local and experienced hires at that school?
They wheel me out when they need me to go talk, something like that. I work with Richard Barth, the CEO of KIPP Foundation. Basically, I'm on call, that whenever there's a need for me to come and help in new expansion, I'll get on the next plane and show up and roll up my sleeves and get to work. So I was there actually in Kansas City getting this up and running about 2 years ago, talking with the Kauffman Foundation and others. But I'm kind of a resource as needed on standby around the country.
And is there a balance that you think ideal between local staff and faculty and the more experienced from other cities that you might bring to a new city?
I think it's, as much as it can be local, it should be great. But they have to be great people. The office manager has to be great, the teachers have to be great, and of course our school leader has to be great. And that's our focus. Thanks.
Tomorrow, anything you need to say? No?
Thanks.